Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Dan Foster of National Review Online is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Dan, you know, Jim Garrity and I have talked about this a lot. I know it's been bandied about among a lot of you over at National Review about who would be perhaps the candidate that would take away that longing for someone else to get in the field for the Republicans in 2012. For some folks, that seems to have been Rick Perry, although it's only about 72, 96 hours into that, so we'll see. But just as folks were getting used to him in the race, once again, we're hearing rumblings of House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan. And he had said emphatically earlier in the year that he wasn't going to run. But according to reports from Steve Hayes over at the Weekly Standard, that thinking started to change when Ryan was surprised that Mitch Daniels didn't get in because he thought Daniels would be a good spokesman for the fiscal responsibility side of this campaign. So this is what Ryan had to say on the Charlie Sykes Show on Milwaukee's big power talker WTMJ last week.
And I just have yet to see a strong and principled articulation of the kind of limited government opportunity society path that we would provide as an alternative to the Obama cradle of the grave welfare state.
Which would indicate that he thinks that he might be able to fill that void, according to Hayes. A lot of a serious discussion going on with strategists and others who would be influential in trying to decide if this is a good move for Ryan. As for Ryan, at the same time he says he doesn't like what he's hearing from the Republican candidates, he also is not suggesting that he's a done deal to get into this race.
I keep hearing that. I'm hoping that people will step up, and I'm hoping that, you know, somebody can come. I can help them fashion this. You know, it's just not, you know, my story and you know my answer. I haven't changed it. We've got a long ways to go. There's 15 months left.
And obviously, he doesn't have much time left to make this decision due to filing deadlines and everything else. But I've got to say, as crowded as this field is, Dan, I'm pretty excited that Paul Ryan still might be thinking about getting in this thing.
A few things to say here. Everyone I've talked to about this who is close to Ryan says that it's for real, that he hasn't made up his mind, but that he's honestly thinking about getting in. The argument for Ryan getting in is that he becomes kind of a much more dynamic, much more interesting Tim Pawlenty, somebody who's perceived to be to the right of Mitt Romney and also much more credible on a conservative message, but who's still considered more palatable to moderate Republicans and mainstream independents than, say, a Michelle Bachmann. And the argument for Paul Ryan getting in is that he occupies that space, and that with Perry in, Perry, who's already in early polling, taken a lot of support away from Bachmann, that leaves an opening for a guy like Paul Ryan to shoot through to number one into the top tier. And he certainly would have no trouble raising money. And I love Paul Ryan. I should just say that now. But I'm more convinced by the argument against Paul Ryan running, which is, what's his path to the nomination? Can he beat Perry or Bachmann in Iowa? Can he beat Mitt Romney, who has huge resources sunk into New Hampshire and has regional credibility? Or can he beat Perry or Bachmann in South Carolina? And those are all, I think, really open questions. I think he'd need to really surprise people and finish a strong second in Iowa, and then he'd need to win New Hampshire to ensure a smooth path to the nomination. I'm just not sure that can happen.
Yeah, the timing of this, even though he does still have time to do it, suggests that it could be an uphill climb given the ground game and the time that you mentioned that you just need to spend in these early states before folks really take you seriously. That clock is running pretty low right now, but I know there's a ton of people who just from listening to him at the televised healthcare summit a couple of years ago to just his way of explaining complicated issues in a very coherent way is something that the Republican Party's been lacking for a little while now. So even if he's not a candidate, he can certainly be an important voice in this campaign.
Absolutely.
On to another issue related to Wisconsin. It was just last week that the Democrats did pick up two Senate seats in the state Senate in the recall elections, all in the aftermath of the legislation from the Wisconsin Republicans to make unions actually chip in a little bit to their retirement and health care and roll back collective bargaining to some extent. They needed to pick up three, so Republicans still held the majority. Two Democrats, two of the 14 who fled the state, you might recall, and hid out in a secure, undisclosed location for a number of weeks while the whole debate was playing out there. They were up for recall as well, one down in the southeastern corner in the Kenosha area, another one up in the Northlands. Unfortunately, Dan, both of them survived the recall. Neither one was particularly close. The one in Kenosha was considered a long shot. The one up north was considered a better shot for Republicans, and some folks are now saying that they didn't recruit the strongest candidate. I guess it's not a huge shock. Recalls aren't usually overly successful, but at the same time, you would think if two Republicans got taken out for actually supporting a plan to ensure fiscal responsibility, that two who completely abandoned their job and their state at the time the debate was going on ought to be kind of given the boot as well.
Yeah, I think this was always a defensive maneuver on the part of the state Republican organization when big labor made it clear that they were going to target as many Republicans in the Senate as they could. The Republicans had to kind of answer with these. I think that they served their purpose, which was to kind of draw off some resources from the recall effort of Republican senators. And we saw the Republicans hold on in the Senate. I mean, I think people didn't really talk about, maybe because there's some fatigue on the story, maybe just because it's the mainstream media, but there wasn't really enough talk about how big of a defeat this was, this recall effort was for labor and for the Democrats. I mean, it's important to realize that even if the Democrats had taken over the Senate, that Walker's reforms would have stayed in place. I mean, the Democrats are going to have to control both houses of the legislature and the governorship to reverse Walker's reforms. But it would have been a big moral victory and symbolic victory for the Democrats. They couldn't even get that. So, you know, this is a bad martini, but it's not all that bad. Things are looking good for reform in Wisconsin. Even if they're not looking so great for Walker's approval ratings, it's crucial that whenever you survey people on whether or not Walker should be recalled, which he'll be eligible for in a few months, the polling always says, and narrowly, but the polling always says that no, he shouldn't be recalled, which, considering his low approval ratings, I mean, I think is a testament to the maturity on this question of the Wisconsin electorate, that this man was duly elected and the Republicans control all three branches, and you know what? They should be allowed to govern.
That certainly is the case. The one thing that concerns me a little bit is, though, that this might be considered a petri dish on just how ready voters are, especially in swing states, to actually embrace the type of fiscal reforms and spending discipline and so forth that's going to be necessary in Washington. And I hope that that folks are ready to do that next year. As we go back and forth in some of these states, it's hard to tell which way.
Sorry to interrupt. The best argument is that it's working in Wisconsin. I mean, we have just anecdotal evidence, but there have been a lot of great stories and stories by Christian Schneider, in particular on National Review, who's our Wisconsin guru, about schools being able to rehire teachers, being able to bring back programs that they had cut in years past, towns saving money. I mean, even Milwaukee, I don't remember if it was the supervisor or the county supervisor or the Milwaukee mayor, I forget the specifics, but was saying, oh, these Walker reforms are going to hurt Milwaukee. Turns out, as a result of the reforms, they're banking an extra $12 million. So the best argument for these reforms is their success. So hopefully, yes, that'll be publicized. People will see this kind of belt tightening and stopping coddling the unions are exactly the kind of medicine we need on the national stage.
Yeah, exactly right. Let's hope that the facts trump the talking points from the big labor mouthpieces that are certainly going to be talking loudly next year. On to martini number three now, which is always our crazy one. And Dan, when you think of economic stimulus, I'm sure you think of when you talk about robust job creation and everything else, that the key to all that is food stamps and more government spending. But that's exactly what Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack is all excited about. He thinks this is one of the best ideas you can put forward in a time of economic difficulty.
When you talk about the SNAP program or the food stamp program, you have to recognize that it's also an economic stimulus. Every dollar of SNAP benefits generates $1.84 in the economy in terms of economic activity. If people are able to buy a little bit more in the grocery store, then someone's got to stock it, shelve it, package it, process it, ship it. All of those are jobs. It's the most direct stimulus you can get into the economy during tough times.
Comments were on MSNBC on Tuesday morning. Dan, since the government's responsible for pumping all that money into the economy, I guess it's taxpayers who are footing the bill here. Wouldn't, you know, reducing some regulations or tax burdens be a slightly smarter approach here? Or are we going to see the president making food stamps a hallmark of his jobs creation program next month?
Yeah, I have no idea where the secretary gets that $1.84 multiplier. That seems wildly optimistic to me. I mean, there is a basic argument when we talk about things like extending unemployment benefits that by putting that money, as it were, into the system, you're making more consumers, you're increasing aggregate demand and things like that. I mean, I'll leave that to the economists to sort out. But food stamps in particular, that seems like a really narrowly applicable thing. You know, we're creating jobs, stocking shelves in supermarkets. I'm not sure whether that's true at all. But even if it is true, it's not the kind of broad-based economic stimulus that you could accomplish by, as you said, reducing barriers to entry into the marketplace, encouraging small businesses, reducing their regulatory burden, reducing their tax uncertainty. There's a lot more tried and true methods that we could go for that incidentally don't involve massive exertions of the welfare state and, as you said, taxpayers footing the bill. So I'm not convinced, Mr. Secretary.
Once again, this administration certainly leading the way forward with great gusto on the way out of this economic downturn. So,
and notice, though, I do think that there's a little bit of a rhetorical lesson here, which is that it used to be that liberals made the appeal of the welfare state on charity or kindness grounds or fairness grounds. But the fact that they feel desperate to say, oh, no, this expanding the welfare state is good stimulus, at least tells you, I think, that common sense is winning the battle about what needs to be done.
Well, let's certainly hope that's the case, both in that debate and what we just mentioned a little bit earlier in Wisconsin. So, Dan, very interesting on all three fronts, as usual, today. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Thanks a lot.
Dan Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.